Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. It's episode 58 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. With me, of course, is the Velvet Glove, Scott. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks, Trevor. How's yourself?
I'm good. I've been busy with work commitments, but that's sort of dying down a bit, and I'm ready to look more deeply into stuff now, so that's good. But
no worries.
Scott, 17th of August today. Did you yes. know that it was only on the 15th of August? Were you aware of the special day, the 15th of August?
No.
I wasn't. You didn't stop for a moment and celebrate the Assumption of the Virgin Mary on the 15th of August?
No, well, see, I wasn't raised a Catholic, so I didn't know anything about that. So.
Of course. That's my Catholic upbringing has caused me to do that. Yes, that was the 15th of August, only 2 days ago, the anniversary.
Right. So what's the Assumption of Mary?
Well, because the Virgin Mary, not only did she give a virgin birth to Jesus Christ, but did you know the Virgin Mary, according to Catholic doctrine, she was conceived by a virgin birth as well. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Yes. So have you heard of the Feast of the Immaculate Conception?
Well, yeah, but I was just assumed that was just garbage. But okay, it's real, yeah. Huh?
Well, yeah. I hadn't thought about it too closely. But the Immaculate Conception actually refers to the conception of Mary, not Jesus. So she's, under Catholic doctrine, deemed to have, you know, not by the normal hanky-panky between mummy and daddy, but by a special intercession that Mary's parents or mother became pregnant. That way, Mary was not born of original sin, and therefore, on her death, it's kind of unclear whether she died or whether she just went straight to heaven, but she didn't have to wait at all. She just was on the express train because born without sin via an immaculate conception and, of course, never sinning during her life. And if not giving birth to Jesus was not enough, she had all that lined up, so she was on the express train to heaven. So,
I had no idea.
So that's a little bit on Mary. So,
thank you for that.
Celebrated that.
That's good to know.
Assumed into heaven on August the 15th. Thanks to Pope Pius the 12th, who we might talk about a little bit later if we have time.
No worries.
Scott, I gave you a list of things we're going to talk about, and you were quite excited that one of them was about Andrew Denton and euthanasia laws.
As you know, and as listeners remember from my stump speech, I am very much a backer of voluntary euthanasia. And I was very pleased when Andrew Denton had came out and said that he was going to campaign for it. And then this article came out: Andrew Denton lashes subterranean Catholic force blocking voluntary euthanasia laws. Mm. And, you know, look, he's kind of hard to argue with because, Kevin Andrews was the leading light of the opposition to the Northern Territory laws back in 1996, I think it was.
Yep.
And, well, 1997, I think they were voted down in the federal parliament. And he is a Catholic. He's a member of the God Squad, they call them, which is the extreme right wing of the Liberal Party.
Mm.
And he also named Tony Burke, who was also he's a member of the Labor Party. And he said, who worked in tandem, he said the joint operation was led on the Liberal side by young Kevin Andrews, a leading member of the Conservative Lions Forum, dubbed by some the God Squad, who worked in tandem with rising Labor star Tony Burke, Denton said. Mm. Now, Tony Burke went off and said that it had nothing to do with his faith or anything like that. And he points to his own position on marriage equality as to why his political leanings are not determined by his faith.
You don't believe him?
I don't really believe him, no. I mean, I think that we've seen... we have seen enough of Christina Keneally and all those sorts of stuff, who's a, you know, she's a member of the Catholic faith, and she's out there in favour of marriage equality and all the rest of it. And you've also seen enough of people around the planet who are turning their back on their faith when it comes to marriage equality. So I think Tony Burke can be shelved on that one. Anyway, it's a good read. And where was the final bit I just wanted to make? Here it is. Denton...
Is this the three bedrock principles?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They're the three bedrock principles, which is what he wants the laws to be based on.
Yeah, so he's saying basically with voluntary euthanasia, according to his formula, three bedrock principles. Firstly, the person would have to be mentally competent adult. Secondly, it would have to be voluntary. And thirdly, the person must suffer from a physical illness, so excluding a purely psychiatric suffering. So he feels with those three bedrock principles, the evils that the anti-euthanasia lobby are talking about don't really apply.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, he's very hard to argue with. I think he's right. You know, and I agree with those three principles that he's put forward.
I just like if the I fact... Tend... You go on.
No, just I was just going to say, it's his father's death is what's prompted him to do this. He remembers his father died 19 years ago from heart failure. And he said it was like watching someone being waterboarded. So it is the sort of scar, viewing a loved one dying like that traumatises you. So I fully understand where he's coming from and fully support him in this, in his endeavour. Yeah, sorry, I cut you off.
No, you're right. I just really like the fact that he's just lashing out at the subterranean Catholic force. Like, this needs to be highlighted, that it's these backroom machinations of these religious groups who are pulling the strings on a lot of these things and will continue to do so. And on this issue, it's voluntary euthanasia, but they're also operating in relation to birth control, gay marriage and drug legalisation, and they're there. And, you know, if you want social progress, you've got to recognise what's driving the anti-progress forces. And it's organised religion in a lot of cases.
It is organised religion in a lot of cases. It's clear that they are the ones behind this. And, you know, I go back to something you said, several months ago now, where you said that once gay marriage was dealt with, the next thing will be voluntary euthanasia. And I think the Catholic Church is already lining up. I think they've probably accepted that they've lost the marriage equality debate, and they're now lining up on voluntary euthanasia.
Yep. And they're starting to work in the background on drug legalisation as well. So they're just, you know... They're relentless, these people. They're absolutely relentless.
They are relentless, and they've got nothing else to fight. It's, you know, it's things like this that come up, and they fight them. You know, it's crazy. Anyway.
All right, Scott. Next one. David Lionhelm is a senator. We mentioned him before. And he's come out in relation to 18C, and he's made a complaint because from Fairfax Media, there's a guy called Mark Kenny, and he described both Lionhelm and that new One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts as a gormless duo who displayed angry white male certitude. And anyway, Lionhelm has come out and said, I really don't like Section 18C, but what I'm going to do is make a complaint under that section to highlight the absurdity of the law, because you know, I've been insulted based on my race, and that's what 8NC is about. And so as a sort of a test case or to highlight the absurdity, I'm going to complain about what I've been called. So that's David Lionhelm.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to take it all that seriously because it is just it is a politician who's coming down on the on 18C and that sort of stuff, and he's gone against his own convictions to make a complaint about it.
Yeah,
I mean, good luck to him, but yeah. we'll see where it goes.
He doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell because what do you have to remember with 18C? It's a funny section. Well, 18C says it's unlawful for a person to do an act that is reasonably likely to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate another person, and that's done because of the race, colour, national, or ethnic origin of the person. So clearly, you know, calling somebody a stupid white fella would be insulting them because of colour. And, you know, fall foul of 18C. But the Act itself has a section 18D, which says something done under 18C that might be unlawful is exempt and is therefore lawful if it's done reasonably and in good faith, and then a whole series of sort of excuses, if you like. And the final one being a fair comment on any event or matter of public interest if the comment is an expression of a genuine belief held by the person making the comment. So all that needs to happen is that Fairfax Media fellow,
Mark
Kenny, simply saying, well, you know, it's a genuine belief I have of a matter of public interest about this senator, and I genuinely hold it, and that would be sufficient in this situation to, you know, to not fall foul. So the 18D exemption would see him not successful in the 18C prosecution. But the whole thing, God, Scott, I mean, you have this really wide-ranging 18C that basically captures all sorts of activities, and then you've got a really wide-ranging 18D which exempts a whole range of activities. It's just ludicrous in my mind. So
yeah, it is. It's the whole bloody law is crazy.
Mm.
But
it should just be all reduced to, if you're going to incite violence against people, that should be stopped, and anything else is fair game, I reckon.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with you. Mm.
Now, Scott, did I send you the one about the Rio Olympic Games and the swimming performance manager? Maybe not.
No, you didn't.
No. Okay. So lots of Olympic news. Lots of new Olympic news, dear listener. And one of the articles I came across was about within swimming. Well, you know, our swimmers haven't performed. Perhaps haven't won as many gold medals as we would have liked, Scott. Fair to say? I mean, we're hoping for more.
Well, it's probably fair to say, but by the same token, they haven't done too badly either, have they?
Yeah, well, I think it's about $9 million per medal. So,
yeah, okay, fair enough.
Is that worth it? I don't know.
No, I don't think it's worth it. I mean, you're speaking to the wrong person here, yeah. Because as far as I'm concerned, the Institute of Sport should be privatised.
I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, the Swimming Australia has a high performance manager called Wayne Lomas, and he's sort of been responding to, you know, criticism, etc., about the team performance, and he sort of wrote an email to the team and to anybody who was interested, and I'll read it. Lomas writes, "As we move towards the conclusion of our Olympic pool competition, it is natural that we begin to reflect on some of the things that we have witnessed this week. In doing this, we have heard and read a lot about team culture. Our team promotes and facilitates a values-driven, learning-oriented, process-focused culture. What this means is that our values drive who we are and how we treat ourselves, our teammates, our sport, and our country. We are committed to the personal and professional growth and learning of our people. We are focused on great processes that enhance performance both in and out of the pool. The key is our language. We have the courage to tackle difficult conversations in a timely and professional manner. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, if that wasn't blah, blah, blah enough. This allows people to maintain a feeling of value and worth. We don't allow ourselves to diminish a person's worth by the language we use. Whether someone achieves peak performance or they miss their own goal and dream through a suboptimal performance, the individual's value is retained. They retain the confidence and support of their teammates regardless. Scott, does that just sound like a lot of management guru, psychoanalysis, hocus pocus nonsense?
It does, yeah. I personally think he's trying to justify $9 million a medal. But
what a load of just gobbledygook. So there is there's a bit of a theory that that team psychologists have had too much influence on the swimming team. And based on that rant by the the special, what's he called? The high performance manager. I'm just a little bit worried. If that's a sort of, does he go into meetings and talk like that? Like, no wonder the swimmers aren't winning gold medals. They're spending their time thinking, what the hell did he just say in that last meeting? What did that mean? Like, just speak in plain English, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate, Scott, in my job, I don't have to listen to rubbish meetings like I know a lot of people are subjected to. And, I had this imagination that that's the sort of talk that often goes on in some of these meetings. And thank goodness I don't have to listen to it.
Well, that's very true, but, you're paying for this lot.
Yes, yeah. Scott, have you ever had a parking fine?
I have, but
what's the most? What's the most you've ever paid for a parking fine?
$120 or something like that. Wow. I had my car parked outside a repair place.
Right.
And it was, inside the Gabba.
Yes.
Traffic area. So, I got done.
Yeah, which is a fair whack. $120, that hurts.
Yeah.
So there's a thing I came across where this lady, she parked at a hospital. She was in a ticketed parking area, but she hadn't purchased and displayed a ticket. And she knew she couldn't. Like, she had to rush into the hospital, and she was prepared to accept a fine and cop it sweet, but circumstances were such that she was in a hurry or whatever, and she was ready for a fine and probably $120 or something like that. So this is the Princess Margaret Hospital, and the fine on the ticket says $1,000. But if she pays by the 31st of August, it'll be modified to $200 for a hospital car park.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with her where she said that you should give free parking to people that have to go to hospital. I don't agree with that. But, $1,000 is outrageous. It's ridiculous, and it's far too bloody high. Now I would have thought she'd have a reasonable argument because she said that she had to get her son in to see a doctor.
Yeah.
Surely she'd have a reasonable argument to have it waived, I would have thought.
Well, often these parking places are privately run, separate to the actual hospital,
Yeah, good point.
Wilson's Parking or somewhere like that. But even so, whoever is in charge of that hospital should be able to say, you are not going to be lumping people with a $1,000 parking fine. Sure, no. Reduced to $200 if you're paid by a certain date, but that is just obscene that should be allowed.
Well, it shouldn't be allowed, and it should be stopped, but $1,000 is crazy.
Scott, have you heard of the term retcon, R-E-T-C-O-N?
No, I haven't actually.
Yeah.
No.
One of our things that our podcast is turning into, Scott, is a little bit of sort of a vocabulary expansion for you and I and and the dear listener. Like, we're learning new words, aren't we?
We are. You know, I mean, it's we're on the back of the cisgender and all that sort of stuff. It's
yes.
great.
Yeah. Yeah. And all those other ones that we were talking about, nihilist and all the rest of it from the other show. So,
yeah.
Anyway, in order to understand the next article, you need to understand the word retcon, R-E-T-C-O-N, and it typically applies in the case of a film or television series or fictional work. Mm-hmm. A piece of new information that imposes a different interpretation on previously described events, typically used to facilitate a dramatic plot shift or account for an inconsistency. So, you know, you might be watching a television series and a certain actor dies, and, you know,
yeah.
but then what it turns out was it was just a dream, and so the actor is still alive and continues on. So what you're watching, you get a different interpretation on it once you receive, you know, new information.
Mm,
so that's okay. That's a retcon.
Right here.
So this little piece that I found was talking about the Jewish faith. Oh, the three Abrahamic faiths: the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. And what it says is, think of it like a movie. The Torah is the first one, and the New Testament is the sequel. Then the Quran comes out and it retcons like the last one never happened. There's still Jesus, but he's not the main character anymore, and the Messiah hasn't shown up yet. Then goes on, Jews like the first movie but ignore the sequels. Christians think you need to watch the first two, but the third movie doesn't count. Muslims think the third one was the best. Oh, I like this one. And Mormons liked the second one so much that they started writing fan fiction that doesn't fit in with any of the series canon. That's great.
It is great, isn't it? You know, I underlined that one too. You know, they started writing fan fiction. Yeah.
Very good. I don't know where that came.
It was very good, yeah.
There's a link there. So we've learnt retcon, and that's great.
Yeah, it is great, yeah. Mm.
Are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook and you can go onto iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast. Back to the Olympics, Scott. Wearing the hijab, one of the American athletes, a lady called Ibtia Muhammad, American Olympic fencer, and she wore a hijab under her headpiece during competition. And for this, she has been lauded as a role model, as having made history and for showing exemplary courage. And the article basically says, well, actually, maybe it would have been more courageous to not wear a hijab and to buck the social pressure that that causes people to wear a hijab, which I thought was a good point.
It was a very good point. And, you know, just there was one part of the article that... Sorry, I'll let you finish before I go into it.
Well, it says that wearing a headscarf in the US is simply not a gesture worthy of the term heroic. You want heroic? How about not wearing a headscarf in Saudi Arabia?
Exactly, yes.
And anyway, you know, the... I don't know. Different people were putting pressure on Michael Phelps and saying that he should step aside.
Yeah, this is the part I wanted to say, yeah.
As the US flag bearer in favour of this woman. What did you want to say about that?
No, I was just going to actually just read that out, you know, that he was under pressure to stand aside and let her be the flag bearer. But, you know, you then go back and you look at her Twitter feed, you know, what's been said by her, it's crazy sort of hysterical. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, she's no role model at all. Like,
no, she's not. She's anti-Semitic. You know, it's ridiculous. Like, you know, this one tweet that really got my heckles up was Israel admits shameful birth control drug injected to unaware Ethiopian Jews.
Yes.
I mean, she's presented it as if the authorities didn't really tell the Ethiopian Jews what they were getting injected with.
Yes.
And it turns out it's not the case, that they just, you know, they were just having birth control injected into them.
Yes. Or they were telling their husbands that they didn't know what it was because they were fearful of telling their husbands they were getting birth control. So
exactly.
So they were fully aware of what they were getting.
Exactly.
But one of her other tweets was that hundreds of Palestinians flee floods in Gaza as Israel opens a dam, which is completely wrong. So
yeah, it's garbage.
Some very nasty anti-Semitic stuff in her Twitter feed. And people are saying that they want her to be carrying the flag for the USA.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just nonsense. It's again this situation that you've got the regressive left, if I can use that term,
yep,
who are jumping on the fact that she's wearing a hijab.
Mm.
You know.
Yep. So.
And Hillary Clinton, you know. You know, she's tweeted, in Rio, Olympic fencer Iptaj Muhammad became the first American Muslim athlete to compete wearing a hijab.
Mm.
I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, it's crazy.
Yes. Anyway. Yes.
And it also makes the point, I forget where it was, I'm pretty sure it was this article, saying that, you know, wearing a hijab is not... It's not a liberalizing thing anyway. It's a mark of suppression of women.
Yeah,
you know,
depends how you view it, but it's very easy to see in most cases a type of oppression and submission. So rather than liberation, yeah,
exactly, yeah.
So well, this is the thing. It's, you know, when you're going to hold somebody up as a hero for a movement, just check their Facebook or their Twitter feed first. I mean, there was that guy on Q&A who was asking a question and he was saying, you know, what do I tell my son about blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, when you went to his Facebook feed, he was saying awful stuff. Again, I think about Jews, anti-Semitic stuff. Like, so the thing about the Muslim... I mean, the Islamic doctrines are so full of anti-Semitic bile and hatred that... Scratch any half-believing Muslim and you've got a fair chance of finding something quite nasty about Jews in there. So
yeah, exactly.
So really not surprising. Mind you, Michael Phelps, who was mentioned in that, is no... we'll have a dig at him as well. I mean, he's 23 gold medals.
Well,
we
might as well, yeah, exactly. You know,
let's have a... It just goes to show that you can get 23 gold medals but still be not that smart.
Exactly.
And perhaps not even looking after your body all that well. Like, because people have seen pictures of him with these round bruises on his body where he's been undergoing a cupping procedure. So glass cups that look like shot glasses being placed over his skin. A vacuum is induced inside the cup by heating the air. Suction pulls the skin up, breaks the capillaries, causing blood to pool and stagnate, creating a bruise. So,
exactly.
Called cupping or sucking method. And Phelps and other athletes undertake them because they believe this process helps muscles to heal more quickly by encouraging blood flow. But in fact, a bruise is a blood clot.
Clot.
And clotted blood is definitely not flowing. So,
it really is crazy that anyone that would think that you can, if you can get bruising to happen, that you're going to end up with your muscles healing faster. It's nonsense.
Mm. So, I mean, 23 gold medals. Imagine how many he could have won if he wasn't cupping. Like,
yeah, exactly.
What's he missed out on? Mm. Oh, more
but I did like the final line in this article. Okay. So the bottom line might be this: if you have the disposable time and money, and cupping makes you feel good, and it's not undertaken at the expense of any evidence-based health endeavours, and you don't have any blood clotting disorders or any other medical contradiction, it's probably not going to hurt you in any other way other than the pain it causes.
Yes,
you know, and that is bang on the money.
Yeah. Yep. So. That's Michael Phelps. The Olympics are nearly over. We've still got another story here. Egyptian judo fighter Islam El Shahabi refused to shake the hand of an Israeli athlete, Orr Sasson, when the Egyptian was thoroughly trounced in their judo fight. And just typical. What do you expect, I guess?
I think it goes back to what you said before about, you know, if you just scratch the surface on any half-believing Muslim, you're going to find a fair amount of anti-Semitism there.
Yeah.
And, you know, Egypt is an Islamic country and, you know, you would assume that their athletes are going to be of the Islamic faith. Mm. And unfortunately, it appears this guy is anti-Semitic and refused to shake his opponent's hand. Mm. It's...
lousy.
Madness. He was lousy, yeah, exactly.
Under the rules of judo, they have to bow to each other at the end of the fight, and he gave the smallest, most perfunctory bow that would be acceptable. They normally shake hands, but under the rules, they have to bow, and he did do that at least. But... you know, Egyptian television sort of commentators of an, you know, this happens just on open Egyptian TV all the time, where prior to the fight, the television guy was saying to the athlete, "My son, watch out. Don't be fooled or fool yourself, thinking you will play with the Israeli athlete to defeat him and make Egypt happy," he said, adding, "Egypt will cry, Egypt will be sad, and you will be seen as a traitor and a normalizer in the eyes of your people." So that was a television commentator urging the Egyptian athlete to not even fight this guy in the first place and to just forfeit the match.
Yeah. You know, it really is maddening because, you know, Egypt would have paid a considerable amount of money to fly this guy to Rio and have him there ready to compete, and the TV journalist is urging him not to compete. Mm. You know, it's crazy.
Mm. If you were if you were an athlete in the Olympic Games and the Egyptians were good competitors in your field, you'd want as many Israeli athletes as possible competing in the hope that it caused the Egyptians to just forfeit. So you'd be encouraging them. Scott, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Now, we've been talking before about Pauline Hanson, Donald Trump. How is it that they're getting their support? Why is it? And here's a study that was done by Gallup based on 87,000 interviews. So that's a pretty good sample, I reckon.
That's a very good sample, yeah.
Mm. And they were questioning people in depth who supported Trump and who didn't support, and trying to find out what their situation was. And I've got a bit of a summary here of what they... I'll just go right to the end of my summary, I think.
Yep.
Basically, blue-collar men of lower-level education. But what they found was, in terms of income, a Trump supporter would perhaps be earning slightly higher income than a non-Trump supporter in that group. So so sort of income wasn't that an indicator of Trump support. So if you had two guys or a group of people, all of them blue-collar men, all of them with sort of lower-level education, the ones with slightly higher income were more likely to be Trump supporters than the slightly lower income.
Mm.
The key thing they found was that they were likely to be a Trump supporter if they lived in an area where there were few opportunities for the next generation So these were blue-collar men, probably worried about their kids not getting ahead, and seeing it would be very difficult for their children.
Yeah.
Typically, they would live in a white enclave where there were no immigrants, and typically, they would, compared to their peers, suffer poor health relatively, probably due to diet, exercise, smoking and drinking, etc. So, so there you have a picture of a Donald Trump supporter. Blue collar, man, low level education, white, obviously. Slightly higher income than his peers. Worried that his kid is going to not attain the same level of, same livelihood as he is. Lives in a white enclave and suffers poor health. So that's a typical Donald Trump supporter. I reckon now, was that going to apply? I reckon that could be a Pauline Hanson supporter as well. I don't know.
Probably, yeah. You know, because we've talked before about the small manufacturing and that sort of stuff that's gone offshore and that sort of thing. And, it could well...
And part of that is, one of the key factors of a Trump supporter was that they live in a white enclave where there's not as many immigrants. And rural Queensland, regional Queensland, would certainly match up with that there wouldn't be as many immigrants in that area as you would in other parts of Australia.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that is dead on the money, yeah.
Yeah. So I just wish we'd have more, thorough surveying of Australian population and a lot of these things. Like, we come across a lot of articles where they've done good research on, American situation like this, or UK Muslims, for example. There's some really good research about their views and things, and seems like we're just scared to really do in-depth surveys of Australian populations, or nobody's doing it, from what I can see.
Well, I think we're scared of it because we're worried about what it's going to uncover.
Yeah.
I think.
Maybe. Scott, there's all sorts of things on the internet with just madcap American pastors and just nutters. And I try to steer away from them because... on the one level, you just go, well, that's just America. And, what happens there, that's just so crazy that we could dismiss it as never happening here. But when we see articles from, say, the UK or New Zealand or Canada, then I look at those a bit more closely and go, well, if it's happening in one of those three countries, there's a fair chance that that could happen
here. It could happen here.
At some stage. So, dear listener, that's part of the thought process of these articles. And this one here that we've got is about Toronto. And a Toronto city councillor sees nothing wrong with a policy that allows the exclusion of non-Muslims from a subsidised building in the city. So they've reached an agreement, the council, with an Islamic group to establish... it's one of these big sort of multi-storey apartment buildings... that's for low rent for poorer people of the community. That's going to be a Muslim only building. Some of the responses by people in Canada is it's wrong on every single level. This goes ahead. If this goes ahead, everything. This goes against everything Canada represents to me. This does not include people. It excludes people. And basically what they're doing, this council, is they've got a human rights code which encourages providing services and facilities to support the members of identifiable ethnic and religious groups. So they've also got a building for Christians. You would never have thought so, would you?
No, you wouldn't have thought so, but, I find that ridiculous because you've got a situation that you've got... if you're going to break it up into religious groups, it comes down to what you're then going to have to do is you're going to have a building for atheists, a building for Mormons, a building for Christians, a building for Jews, and a building for Muslims, and then Buddhists and everything else. They're never going to meet.
And that's just happening in a civilized country like Toronto, where...
You know, exactly. Yeah. It's crazy.
But I think that's it's exaggerated civilization, and it's very uncivilized. So.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely madness. Hmm. It really is crazy.
Scott, in the past, I have mentioned a few things about the Satanic Temple.
Yes, and you want to set up a chapter of the Satanic Temple in Australia.
The more and more I read about them, the keener I am to do it. They're really...
And this one, it really tickled my fancy. Yeah. I'll let you go with it. It's hilarious.
Yeah. So there's a place called the Westboro Baptist Church in America.
And they're the ones that have that turn up to protest at... dead soldiers' funerals and that sort of stuff with, you know, God hates gays and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Terrible homosexual stuff, like anti-gay stuff, like just awful. And the founder and leader of the group is Fred Phelps Jr. And so they... So the Westboro Baptist Church announced their intention to protest the funerals of the Boston bombing victims. The church never showed up, but they later issued a statement saying they were there in spirit. And they do a whole bunch of really nasty things like this. So the Satanic Temple decided that a ceremony celebrating same-sex couples at the gravesite of Fred Phelps' mother was an appropriate way to meet the Westboro Baptists in spirit, but this time on our terms. So what they've done is they've said, you're so homophobic, you homophobic nutter, but they went to the guy's mother's grave and performed a pink mass over the grave. It's a satanic ritual performed after death that turns the deceased straight spirit into a homosexual one. Not unlike the Mormon practice of baptizing the dead, only much gayer. What a great sense of humor these people have got. So they went to the graveyard of the Phelps family, and they performed two pink masses, actually, one with a female couple and another with a male couple. And there's pictures of them, of the couples kissing over the grave of this guy's mother. And they say, now the spirit of Catholic Idolette Johnston is officially into other chicks, meaning her grave sign is a visible target for one of her son's God hates fags protests. Where's it going there? He says, we haven't gayed Fred's father yet, or his great aunt Irene, who raised him after his mother died. We will perform pink masses for each of them and more descendants of the Phelps each time they picket funerals or applaud horrific terrorist actions, as they are known to do. Fred himself is getting pretty long in the tooth, and I hope to be presiding over his pink mass before long.
It was hilarious. I read it and I cracked up the whole way through it. It was brilliant. So my hat is off to the Satanic Temple in the United States.
If I form a chapter, will you join, Scott?
I'll join. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Because they don't believe in Satan as a deity. It's a metaphorical concept of rebellion. So
yeah, exactly.
Still got to get my head around that, but I really like them. And then another article where the Mississippi police are wanting to arrest the Satanists who turn dead people gay. So they've tried to issue a warrant for his arrest for this Leishan Greaves. And he said, in his defence, he says, we caused no material damage to anything, and the cemetery was left exactly as it was when we entered it. I'm not sure which part of this is most problematic for the sheriff, the displays of homosexuality or the Satanism. I do know that the combination of the two is bound to cause absolute havoc among the superstitious homophobic. And He says, I predict that if I were to be arrested and extradited to Mississippi, my very presence would raise unholy psychological hell among the sheriff and his colleagues. I believe it quite possible I could find myself in a holding cell witnessing the Meridian police devolve into a sweaty, grunting, savage orgy of uncaged homosexuality, all influenced by the idea that they were utterly powerless against my sexual conversion magic. Brilliant.
Oh, dear. Mm. Yeah.
Scott, have you ever caught an Uber?
I have caught an Uber, actually, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I caught an Uber twice, actually, so, right. Yeah. I was quite impressed with them. They were significantly cheaper than a cab.
Yep.
And, you know, the guy came, he picked me up from the hotel I was at, mm-hmm. brought me home. It was only $20.
Yep.
Hmm.
Had a drink and some mints in the car as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I've never caught one, but my kids have caught one all the time. I mean, I'd never catch a taxi. My kids have caught way more taxis than I've ever caught in my life. So, just the younger generation.
Well, I think that I think the younger generation is they're up with it and that sort of stuff. So they've got to,
The Queensland government has announced that it's going to legalise Uber in Queensland, and the Premier has allocated, well, has just grabbed $100 million. $100 million, Scott, out of how many swimming gold medals is that? Like, that's
well, that's probably 10. Yeah,
it's getting up there. Mm. For a taxi package to compensate the taxi industry, I think each taxi will end up getting each taxi license will end up getting $10,000 or something like that.
Mm.
Anastasia Palaszczuk says it's not their fault the world is changing. She said of the mums and dads who had invested in taxi licences only to see a modern new world devalue their investment. Scott, if we're going to start compensating people because the world's changed and industries have changed, we'll be forking out money left, right and centre. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's... When I first read it and that sort of stuff, I thought to myself, well, she's got a point. You know, you've got to compensate them. But then I sat down and I thought about it and I went back and read it again. And I'm with you. I don't think you can compensate an industry just because the world has changed, you know.
Yeah.
I think it would have been sticking our head in the sand if we'd tried to hold out and say that it's illegal, you shouldn't have it and that sort of stuff. Because, I mean, it's been illegal and I've caught two of them, you know. Yeah. It's crazy that you would try and stick to this line saying it's illegal, you've got to stop and that sort of stuff. And but then to go in and rip $100 million out from consolidated revenue and chuck that around, I find that madness. And, you know, sorry.
There is an argument that I would accept this argument. If she said, you know, we've created rules and regulations banning people from certain activities and we've then charged people money for licenses based on those rules being enforced and now we're changing the laws and allowing anybody to do it, I could see, I can sort of come around to compensation for that, if that's how it sort of worked, do you know what I mean? But to just say, oh, well, the world's changed and because of that we're going to give you money, like, that's not a good reason. It should be, we had a legislative arrangement which protected you and now we're pulling the rug out from under you. So, and you paid lots of money for that legislative protection and now we're compensating you because we've taken it away with zero notice. That's okay. But the way she said it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you've got a point there. I'm not 100% convinced anymore.
I'm not sure how much the legislation had to change, but I think that's kind of the theory. But but the way she was talking, I mean, my family, my mother was involved in a costume hire business. It did quite well for many, many years. But then people just started buying costumes on the internet and the whole hiring of costumes completely collapsed. So, you know, you didn't go to the government saying, oh, can I have some money because my industry's changed? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
So she needed to... If the reason was because of what I've just said, she should have said that rather than the way she said it.
Well, I think so too, yeah. Yeah.
The Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove and the Twelfth Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party. And while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. Scott, we've got a little bit of time, and I've been working my way through a really interesting book. It's called The Vatican Exposed by Paul L. Williams. It's about money, murder, and the mafia, and it's a real... forensic examination of the Vatican down through history, and I thought it'd be good, worthwhile. I'm only a quarter of the way through it, but it's absolutely fascinating what the Vatican has been up to in its history.
Do tell.
With your permission, dear listener, and Scott, I'll just fire away with a bit of this history and on the Vatican, because it just... You know, this is the classic example. This is the group that we're told, you know, the church is so moral and deserving of special dispensation and advantages because of their moral guidance. And then listen up to what they've been up to. So 312 after Christ, common era. Emperor Constantine defeated his rival Maxentius to become the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. And he attributed his victory to a vision of a cross. So he decides to make the God of Christians the God of the Empire. So good news for Christians in 312. So they have a number of centuries where everything's going swimmingly because they're the official religion. In 756, Peter the Short, in return for the title Father of Rome, gave huge amounts of land to the Holy See. You've heard the expression the Holy See?
Yeah, I've heard the expression the Holy See. Yeah.
Refers to the holy seat of St. Peter. The amount of land this guy gave just for the title Father of Rome was almost all of modern Italy, like handed to the Vatican in 756. In the 1500s, you've got the Reformation, and the wealth and power of the church begins to erode. 1789, you've got the French Revolution. The French forfeited all of the church assets in France to the state, forbade bishops from sending money back to Rome. Napoleon charged Rome an annual tribute, and when they failed to pay it, he sent his soldiers in and sacked all the palaces and cathedrals for gold and precious art. So that's he's gone up in my estimation, Napoleon.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. So that's in the late Napoleon.
In the late 1700s. By 1860, all but one of the Papal States had declared independence. So that land that they'd got in 756 was divided into Papal States, and all but one had declared independence and cut away from the Vatican. 1870, the very last Papal State, the National Troops of United Italy took it back and left the Vatican with just 480,000 square metres around Vatican Hill, which is pretty much what we know of Vatican City today.
Right.
So we're up to, you know, they had a great start in things, the Vatican, but by 1870 they had virtually no land and therefore no taxation. No rents to get any income. So we're then up to 1920s. They invested their last reserves of money in the Ottoman Empire. So they, goodbye to that money.
Yes.
And there was the rise of communism in Italy. And the problem for the church was that communism rejected the teachings of the church. So the Vatican formed the Catholic Populist Party to combat communism, early 1920s. We've then got the rise of Mussolini, and he wants power, obviously, and to get it, he needs the help of the Vatican, which is controlling the Catholic Populist Party and also controlling the hearts and minds of many Italians. So so he does a deal. Mussolini does a deal with the Vatican where he says, if you abandon the Catholic Populist Party, then I'll give you some nice presents in return. And in 1929, Mussolini and the Vatican signed the Lateran Treaty. And the first part of this is called the Concordat. And under that treaty, all church organizations were exempt from tax and from audit. Catholicism was declared the official religion of Italy. The Vatican City was declared a sovereign state. The Vatican relinquished all claims to land seized in 1870, and Mussolini gave the Vatican $90 million. So in 1929, they just cut a deal with Mussolini and went from rags to riches overnight. Like, at that point, the Vatican was infested with rats. Like, they had no money at all. They were dead broke. And they cut that deal with Mussolini. So rags to riches there.
Mm.
And they also had then the good luck of a new finance guy called a Bernardino Nogara. And he's been described by some within the church as the greatest thing that happened to the church since Jesus Christ. He was the finance guy. Fluent in eight languages, photographic memory, and he could compute numbers faster than an adding machine. He was totally devoted and incorruptible. Like, he was just the perfect guy to put in charge of this windfall of money for a church that at that point had been a long time since they had any. And one of the reasons they were poor, Scott, was that, you know, this concept, we know about it in the Muslim faith where making money from interest is prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware of that in the Muslim faith?
Yeah, usury. Yeah,
usury, yes. Usury, yeah. Usury? Well,
usury, I believe it is.
That was the case in the Catholic Church up until this Bernardino Nogara got this money from Mussolini.
Yeah.
So in various councils in the Catholic Church, in 324, 371, 538, 626, 789, 1179, 1745 and 1836, at all those various councils, they confirmed that you could not, as a Catholic, make money from interest. And this Bernardino Nogara said, well, that's just crazy. You know, we need to be engaged in business, and they just dropped it overnight. So he invested their money, was making squillions from it very cleverly.
Mm.
So where was I then? That was 1929. Hitler is coming to power in Germany, and he needs the help of the Catholic Church for his dream of the Third Reich. And he's seen the deal that Mussolini has cut with the Catholic Church. So he approaches the Catholic Church, gets them to drop their support for the Catholic Centre Party in Germany, and in return, says, 1933 agreement between the Vatican and Hitler is criticism of the Catholic Church is prohibited in Germany. Church tax of 9% on all German Catholics is implemented, and this is deducted from their paychecks. Now, you know how we've talked in the past about in Germany, people were leaving the Catholic faith because they were getting, I think we said 9%, 10%, but of money just automatically deducted from their paychecks. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, still, we did talk about that some time ago.
Where it's still happening today. If you are if you are raised a Catholic in Germany, when you get your pay, it will have a deduction for state tax, and there will be a deduction of either 9 or 10% going straight to the Catholic Church. And that has its foundations in a deal done between the Vatican and the Hitler
Third Reich.
In 1933. Amazing. Anyway, at the time, Pope Pius XI was in charge, and he was a kind of an ill pope towards the end of his reign. But he was getting advice from various people after that agreement in the years following, saying, this Hitler character is a nasty piece of work. We have to condemn him. Like, we can't keep backing him because he's committing atrocities. And Pius XI agreed, you know, yes, we must condemn Hitler. And he had drafted like an encyclical type document, and he was ready to pronounce that and hand that down, but he died the day before the scheduled date for doing that.
Really?
In mysterious circumstances, and in this book it describes that he was most likely assassinated by Cardinal Pacelli, P-A-C-E-L-L-I. Cardinal Pacelli was the main player in the negotiations with Hitler. So he was the one in Germany doing all the deals with Hitler. This book says that it was Cardinal Pacelli who killed, assassinated Pope Pius XI. Of course, Scott, when a pope dies, you need a new pope. I'm going to give you one guess as to who was elected Pope Pius XII.
Pacelli?
Correct. So the guy who was in bed with Hitler and who was just responsible for that mayhem, most likely assassin of Pope Pius XI, and he ends up getting elected as the Pope, and he becomes Pope Pius XII. So at that time, then, the Vatican Bank is created, and the Vatican Bank, Scott, is interesting. It's not a branch of the Vatican at all. It's got one stockholder and one person in charge of it, and that's the Pope. Like, it's the Pope's bank. It's not the Vatican's bank. And this all traces back to Pope Pius XII. So when the Vatican publishes financial reports, they'll publish on everything except the Vatican Bank, because that's the Pope's. Incidentally, at this time, this is the same Pope Pius XII who decided the Virgin Mary was conceived without sin and therefore went straight to heaven. And he gave that papal authority, so that's the same guy. Then, 1941, Hitler invades Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia is then divided into Catholic Croatia and Orthodox Serbia. And the Catholic Croatia is controlled by a really nasty fascist called Ante Pavelić, and he's given enormous help and assistance by Catholic Archbishop Stepinac. And between the church and these fascists, they commit terrible genocide of Jews and Serbs. They've got death camps, and the several commandants and officers of the death camps were Catholic priests. Huge financial windfall made its way back to the Vatican. And there was a Zagreb war crimes trial, 5th of October 1945, and the evidence given was that Catholic priests, armed with machine guns, massacred Orthodox Serbs. And you know, priests were convicted of this at the war crimes trial, and the evidence came from Catholic peasants who had seen it. So When Pius XII heard about the conviction of his priests, he uttered a cry of outrage and ordered the excommunication of everyone involved in the Zagreb war trial, meaning the excommunication of the prosecutors and the judges, not of the priests. And between 1941 and 1945, in the former Yugoslavia, 500,000 Orthodox Serbs, 80,000 Jews, and 30,000 Gypsies were exterminated. On a per capita basis, it was the greatest incident of mass murder in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And Scott, I am a quarter of the way through the book, and these are the atrocities that are being outlined. Fascinating.
One would hope that the atrocities become less blood-soaked as you go further through the book, but I suspect... how far does it go up? Does it go into the paedophilia?
I believe there's a small section on paedophilia. Most of it's to do with finances, and there's a big section coming up on how they shuffled Nazis around the world to South America and stuff as well to escape... But this Pope Pius XII is just an awful, awful man. And and this book is just full of all references and endnotes, and it's extremely well researched. Like, it's not just off the top of his head. He's got it really well referenced. So so I'm quite enjoying that one, Scott. So there'll be more of that in the future.
Hmm.
Right. Well, we're up to our time limit. So, Scott, that's the end of episode 58. Dear listener, if you are listening this podcast early enough, we've got a meeting of the Secular Party on Sunday Brisbane. Come along and join us and help us plan the next 3 years, or at least have a cup of coffee with us and have a good, you know, ear bash about religious stuff.
Yeah.
Feel free to join us. Scott, I'll see you on Sunday.
I'll see you on Sunday. Thank you very much for listening. Bye now.
Good night. Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone. And just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.